Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case this morning is International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers versus Illinois Bell. Mr. Sorrells.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. This case concerns new employee work performance guidelines that Illinois Bell established in its residential services unit. These were essentially a sales target program. The union filed a grievance, and the grievance was not resolved through the grievance procedure. The question before the district court, and now before this court, is whether the company is obliged to arbitrate this dispute. Now, how should this question be answered? Well, every case that we cited in our brief, and I think every case that the union cited as well, essentially follows the same mechanism. First of all, it's the court that has to answer that question. It's not one that can be punted off to an arbitrator. And secondly, the court answers that question by looking to the language of the specific contract at issue. And if you look at the language of the contract at issue in this case, the party's collective bargaining agreement, you see one particularly notable feature is that the grievance clause is broader than the arbitration clause. The union can grieve any dispute whatsoever, but arbitration is limited to two arbitrable topics, as they're called. And it says only those arbitrable topics. And the primary arbitrable topic that's at issue here is the first, which says that a dispute...
You can have implied conditions as well, can't you?
Well, you could, but there's no evidence here that the parties intended to arbitrate anything other than the arbitrable topics that were listed. In fact, it has the word only, which suggested that they did not intend to imply anything additional.
How about the no-strike clause? I think you can imply a lot of things from a no-strike clause, can't you? There's a very broad no-strike clause. There's just no strike for any reason, right?
Well, there's a no-strike clause, but there's also a very specific arbitration clause, and in this court's precedence, it always looks to the language of the particular contract at issue. And the language here is that there's...
No, but if you have no right to strike and you have no right to arbitrate, what recourse do you have?
Well, you certainly have recourse. Look, the parties agreed to arbitrate certain things and not others. The things that they did not agree to arbitrate, and there's quite a few things, would be subject to bargaining, be subject to interim bargaining. It would be subject to being revised in the next agreement.
And any discipline imposed under this new policy would be arbitrable?
Absolutely. That's specifically authorized by the second arbitrable topic very, very expressly. And the union can then raise the adequacy of these, the propriety of these work performance standards as part of the just cause determination. In fact, it makes a lot more sense to do it that way, because if you did it now, what would an arbitrator have to go on? There's not a single word. The contract is 200 pages. There's not a single word in it about work performance. You know, it covers automobile mileage reimbursement and meals and a lot of other things, but the parties carefully drafted an agreement.
Is this sort of like a production standard, what we're talking about here? You know, a manufacturing plant, you know, how many widgets can you process in an hour?
What
we're talking about?
No, what we're talking about is really represents a change from the old local phone company to what we have now, where they're competing with dozens of other companies to sell services and products like high-speed internet service. And so under these guidelines, you get a score based on your sales year to date, and if you're below that score, you get put into a kind of a probationary program called the performance improvement program, during which you're coached in how to sell better. And if after a certain time you're still below the level that you're expected to be, you get a warning letter and a one-day suspension. And then if you're still below it, it can lead to progressively more serious discipline.
It measures your sales ability, or is it how many jobs you can perform in a day's time?
No, actually, the previous program was based on flow. You know, if the customer did this, then you're supposed to do that. This program is based on sales. And, like, you know, it's harsh, but a lot like a lot of sales forces around the in virtually all, throughout all industries, you've got to produce, and that's what this program is based on.
The discipline is arbitrable, but so what we're doing is a piecemeal determination rather than doing it all at once?
Well, if employee gets disciplined, you get to then that employee can raise the propriety of these guidelines, but in context. You can see what else would be involved in that employee's responsibilities that maybe would explain why the guidelines weren't appropriate in the context, in a particular context. To do it up front, the parties just didn't provide for that because there would be nothing for an arbitrator to go on based on this contract. And what the contract says is that the party that's the proponent of arbitration has to point to a specific provision or term in the contract that is involved in resolving this dispute. And the union went through this contract, and they couldn't come up with anything. What they did do is convince the district court that Section 4.01, which not only doesn't mention work performance standards, it doesn't mention work performance at all, that somehow is a governing term or provision. But Section 4.01 is simply, it really doesn't concern.
You seem to be saying if it is not specifically mentioned expressly in the contract, it's non-arbitrable. Is that your
position? Well, it's not only our position.
That's a pretty extreme position.
Well, it's not our position. It's what the contract says. It says it has to involve the application or interpretation of a term or provision of the contract. And there is no term or provision of the contract dealing with work performance because the parties do not agree to make work performance issues arbitrable. What Section 4.01 deals with is respect between the company and the union. You know, it says that we're going to disagree on things, but we have to treat each other in a business-like manner. You know, we can't put on the bulletin board that all union leaders are corrupt, and you can't put on your bulletin board that all, you know, management officials are plutocrats. Let's conduct ourselves in a business-like way. Well, that has nothing whatsoever to do with this dispute between the parties.
Well, was there a due cause provision in the contract that to be fired, it has to be for due cause? Is that spelled out in the contract?
There's a just cause provision in Section 13 when it comes to disciplinary actions. And that's where an employee can, and in fact, right from the very beginning, the company represented to the union that if anyone is disciplined as a result of this, that you can raise this in your just cause grievance. But the party never agreed, the company never agreed that its policies would be subject to arbitration right from the get. Remember, there are policies implemented.
The policies are, and eventually, if grievances are pursued or disciplinary action is pursued, then it is subject to modification, right?
Oh, absolutely.
By an arbitrator.
Well, absolutely. It will be found to have been not, the discipline will have been found not to be in just cause, and the actual effect of that,
well, that
will force
the proposition is at least implied in the contract that you can't be fired except for just cause. I'm not talking about a specific situation, but that general proposition.
That's right. You cannot be fired except for just cause. And
I mean, wouldn't that follow from the prohibition of strike, the anti-strike provision?
Well, you don't really need to address the anti-strike provision. There's a specific just cause provision, and if somebody is disciplined, you can determine whether it was for just cause in context. What the parties didn't agree to do was to say that management policies, which are made every day, would be subject to arbitration in and of themselves. And they specifically said that unless there's a provision in the contract that governs the disputed issue, that you can't arbitrate it. And so they set up a different kind of procedure, and the courts are supposed to respect what the parties put into particular contracts rather than rely on broad presumptions that may or may not have anything to do with the particular contract language at issue. In fact, the broad presumption that the district court relied on is at odds with the language of this contract because a presumption would put the burden on the party opposing arbitration, in this case the company, to rebut it. But the language of the contract puts the burden on the party seeking arbitration to point to a provision in the contract that addresses the particular type of dispute that's at issue. And there is nothing in the contract that addresses work performance. Now, the union has argued that The second arbitrable topic, discipline, it governs the disputed issue because at some point in the future, somebody may be disciplined, and therefore that implicates these guidelines. But as the Ninth Circuit ruled in the Alcoa case, the logic of that means that the arbitration limitations mean nothing because every policy would have to be arbitrated because every policy, if it's violated, could conceivably lead to discipline. And for that reason, Justice Kennedy rejected the union's position in a very similar contract where the grievance procedure was broader than the arbitration clause, that the mere fact that there's a discipline provision would govern, would require arbitration of management policies. So given this contract language, a presumption really has no role to play. And in fact, in the union's response to our supplemental authority letter, it said it does not rely heavily on a presumption, but rather on what is required by the collective bargaining agreement. And we agree with that, and it's consistent with this court's cases, which have always looked to the specific language of the contract. And we cited five or six cases from this court that have rejected similar arguments that issues were arbitrable based on a pure presumption where the language of the contract didn't fit with it. Now, the union also argues that, well, what's required to see if a term of the contract applies, you have to construe the contract, and that's a role for the arbitrator, so therefore the case should go to arbitration. But this court's cases have rejected that. It consistently said, based on the Supreme Court's AT&T case, that issues like this are for the court to decide. And even though you might have to construe, at least on sort of facially, a contract provision to see whether it applies or not, that's not the same as resolving the merits of the case. We're not asking the court to resolve the issue of the propriety of the guidelines, but simply whether this contract requires this type of dispute to be arbitrated. Now, there are only three exceptions to the rule that courts decide these issues, and it's not supposed to be punted to the arbitrator. One of them is where the parties clearly and unmistakably agreed that an arbitrator would decide arbitrability questions. That's what the Supreme Court said in AT&T, and then in the commercial context in First Options. There's no such language in this contract. A second exception would be for procedural arbitrability issues. You know, were the steps of the grievance procedure complied with and so forth? Again, there's no procedural issue at stake here. It's the substantive question of the guidelines that the union wants to arbitrate. And the third exception is the prima facie exception, which deals with contract formation, which is not at issue here. So clearly, this is an issue for the court to decide, and it's supposed to decide it based on the language of the contract, which requires the union to find a term or provision that applies to this dispute, and simply saying that, well, these guidelines could lead to discipline sometime in the future. If the parties had intended to make everything that could lead to discipline arbitrable before discipline is implemented, they would have said so. But instead, they provided only for discipline of, quote, an employee. And until an employee has been disciplined, there's no basis for sending a case like this to arbitration. That's basically our position. I'll reserve my remaining points for reply. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Bennett.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. The contract, contrary to what counsel said, the contract doesn't say that it must be that the first part of the arbitration provision is limited to specific provisions of the contract. It says provisions of the contract. There are a number of cases cited in both of our briefs where the contract in its arbitration clause does say that arbitration is limited to explicit or specific provisions. This isn't one of them. Similarly, the discipline clause, and incidentally, I don't think there actually is a just cause provision, an explicit just cause provision in the contract. Your Honor is right, of course, that that's standard practice to imply that within collective bargaining agreements, and that has been done here. So I don't think it matters a great deal that there's not an explicit one, but I think as a matter of fact, there's not an explicit just cause provision. But the reference to the other
clause... Well, I was just trying to identify your opponent's position as to whether provisions have to be explicit in order to be arbitrable.
Understood. And I think the clearest evidence that that's not the case is that, unlike a number of cases cited by both of us where the contract does say it has to be a specific provision, an explicit provision, this one doesn't say that. Similarly, the reference to discipline doesn't say that it is only an issue if discipline is imposed. It says if it involves discipline. Now, an arbitrator might read that to say, I'm only interested if discipline is imposed, but I suggest an arbitrator could just as well read that clause to say, if it could lead to discipline, I will decide on the propriety of these standards. Now, whether it has to do with how many widgets you produce an hour or how many sales you make or whatever it is, it's a work standard. It's a new work standard that you have to meet. Let's stay with the widgets, because I guess we're all sort of used to the manufacturing world that may be leaving us. If the employer says, if it used to be the rule that if you manufactured 12 widgets a minute, you were doing okay, and then halfway through the contract, the employer says, you've got to manufacture 50 widgets a minute, well, what's going on here if we say you can't challenge that until somebody is fired for not manufacturing the 50? What we're saying is they've got to work so hard. What are they going to do, collapse? They put themselves, the only way they can challenge it is putting their jobs at risk. It may be that an arbitrator called upon to interpret the contract would say, yeah, fellas, that's the deal. You must, if you don't want to manufacture, if you want to challenge their ability to say, now instead of 12 widgets, you've got to manufacture 50, manufacture only 12, get fired, and come talk to me, and we'll see what happens.
That's an argument that the arbitrator decides arbitrability, which is not the law.
Your Honor, I don't think it is a question of the arbitrator deciding arbitrability. There's no question that the arbitrator doesn't decide arbitrability. But if the contract clause is susceptible to an interpretation that would allow the arbitrator to rule in a certain way, then it should be found arbitrable, and the arbitrator then makes the decision.
How is Section 4.01 susceptible to such an interpretation?
It creates what we referred to as this responsibility, respect, and fairness obligation.
With respect to the application of the terms of the agreement.
That's correct.
So what other term of the agreement is in play here apart from 4.01?
Well, the discipline clause itself could be one that's in play. That is the ability to engraft onto the implied just cause provision of the contract for discipline purposes the notion that not meeting certain performance standards allows the employer to discipline you. Counsel has said that it goes in, you're on probation, and then you're subject to discharge if you don't meet the standards. And if that is deemed to be a part of the working relationship, then the discipline clause itself has been applied in such a way, or is subject to application by the employer in such a way, as to say it's now legitimate to discipline for not meeting these performance standards. But in 4.01 itself, turn to 4.01 itself, which is the one that the district court relied on, there is the general language about responsibility and respect, and separate from that, the fair application of the contract. I believe that the company has essentially conceded that point in their reply brief. In my brief, I suggested that although there's nothing in the contract that prohibits this or refers to it, that if the company said all employees have to wear dunce caps and signs saying I'm a bum, that the union would raise that.
Far-fetched hypotheticals aren't really helpful in contract interpretation. Basically, your argument in that respect makes every dispute arbitrable, because the union can always claim that management is being disrespectful.
That may be the case, Your Honor. And if that is the case, the way to exclude that. That's a very broad provision they negotiated, 4.01. Now, there are provisions of the contract where they've said this issue is not subject to arbitration. They've specifically excluded certain things. Now, if one of those explicitly excluded provisions were made the subject of a challenge, and the union said, we say that that is being disrespectful or irresponsible or unfair, then I believe the exclusion, the specific exclusion of that action from arbitration would trump the 4.01, the reference to 4.01. But in this case, that's not there, and that's why I recognize that it was a far-fetched hypothetical. But the point is that, and counsel agreed, that even though the contract doesn't have specific language saying the company can't do certain things, whether it's imposing new performance guidelines or the admittedly far-fetched hypothetical I presented, even though the contract doesn't say the company cannot do those things, if we assert that the doing of it is a violation of 4.01 and it's not excluded, then the company said, certainly under the hypothetical I presented, they said, yes, that would be arbitrable, but they say that performance guidelines wouldn't be arbitrable because they aren't really a violation of the respect, responsibility, and fairness provision. But that's just the point. That's what an arbitrator is called on to decide. That the company, in saying that if in the hypothetical that that would be arbitrable under 4.01, but the performance guidelines wouldn't be arbitrable because they're not a matter of responsibility, respect, and fairness. What they're saying essentially is that if they feel they violated the contract, then it can be arbitrated under 4.01. But if they feel they haven't violated the contract, as with the performance guidelines, then it's not subject to arbitration. The whole notion of arbitration is that it's the arbitrator who gets the information and has the expertise and background to make that decision. Now, it may seem that imposition of performance guidelines is a very standard thing, that sure, why shouldn't an employer be able to do it, whereas the dunce cap so obviously is not acceptable. But if the evidence comes in front of the arbitrator that the contract was negotiated with certain guidelines, with certain performance standards required and understood, and everybody signed the deal saying for this amount of a raise and for everything else that went into the contract would go forward and the employment relationship would continue. And then in the midst of that, the employer changes the guidelines, the performance standards, to ones that are totally unreasonable, to ones that go beyond anything that anybody would have contemplated, and perhaps ones that would be impossible to satisfy, that no employee could be expected to satisfy them.
Well, their argument there, this piecemeal effect, is that you don't have anything to work with. If there, say, there are new standards, how is the arbitrator going to apply that?
That's for the parties and the arbitrator to decide in arbitration, but I know if I were presenting the case for the union, I would present the evidence. Were standards in effect when the contract was negotiated? And in fact, I think counsel agreed there were standards, and these changed them to adapt to what the company feels were its current business needs. What were those standards? How were the employees expected to deal with them? The company may in turn present evidence or attempt to present evidence that during bargaining it was negotiated. Perhaps they'd present evidence that the union tried to negotiate a provision in the new contract saying you can't change the performance standards. And they said, nothing doing, we're not going to agree to that. We would also undoubtedly, on behalf of the union, seek to present evidence about the practical effect of the changes. Does it change the job? If the performance standards shifting from what counsel described as a workflow system, meaning you've got to go through certain steps when you respond to each customer call, to an actual sales system, meaning you've got to sell a certain number of cable television or cell phones or whatever each time someone calls, whatever it is, if that changes the job completely, the company hasn't done anything to train the employees, hasn't given the employees a chance to adapt to it, well, those are things that the arbitrator would look at and would consider. And how the arbitrator would come down, we don't know. But this is all the sort of thing that that arbitrators do.
Maybe we could go, counsel, back to the precise language of the arbitration clause itself.
Yes.
It says that the right to arbitrate shall extend only to matters which involve the interpretation or application of the terms and provisions of the agreement.
Yes.
In what sense are these performance guidelines an interpretation of Section 4.01? Or in what sense, alternatively, are the performance guidelines an application of 4.01?
I don't think it's our position isn't that they're an application of 4.01, but rather that the term or provision of the contract on which we rely, along with the others, along with the discipline, but as far as 4.01, that it is the term or provision. It says that there has to be responsibility, respect, and fairness in application of the contract. And once we say that, we may or may not be able to convince an arbitrator of it,
the performance guidelines do not purport to interpret or apply Section 4.01, and according to the language of the arbitration clause, it's therefore not arbitrable.
Your Honor, I believe that...
Just an assertion that the performance guidelines constitute an act that is disrespectful of the union or unfair, I think is not a proper interpretation of the limiting language in the arbitration clause.
Well, but the contract is not very... The arbitration clause is not very limited at all. It talks about matters which involve interpretation or application of any of the terms or provisions. Now, rather than looking first at the performance guidelines, we look first at 4.01. It creates...
Well, we have to look first at the subject matter of the grievance, which is the performance guidelines.
Certainly. And the union's position is that the manner in which the employer imposed these performance guidelines is a violation of its obligation to behave in a manner that is responsible, respectful, and fair.
If that's a correct interpretation of the arbitration clause, then every dispute between management and labor is arbitrable under 4.01.
Well, that may very well be. I would only qualify it, Your Honor, by saying every dispute that the parties have not excluded. It's very easy to exclude a dispute. They've excluded certain disputes. The parties have agreed to exclude certain disputes from arbitration. There are cases, many cases, that explain how parties can effectively exclude something.
So it's your position that anything that's not specifically and expressly excluded is included by virtue of your interpretation of 4.01?
Well, 4.01 is that broad, is very broad. Now, the language and counsel cited in their brief, Professor Cox's article, saying that language that attempts to invoke arbitration that are patently frivolous perhaps might be excluded. Similarly, Judge Marshall in the Montgomery Ward Teamster 710 case said that if a provision is invoked, I don't know if he used the phrase bad faith, but invoked purely for the purpose where there's no application. But in this case, the company agreed to a provision, 4.01, that is very broad, or at least is subject, an arbitrator may find that it covers various things, that a very broad range of things are prohibited by it. Once the company agreed to that broad a provision in 4.01 and didn't exclude 4.1 from what is subject to arbitration, then any specific actions that are not under the contract made matters of management discretion or excluded from arbitration are properly brought within 4.01.
I know your time has run out, but let me ask you this question and make sure I understood it. As part of the collective bargaining agreement, you along with the company agreed to exclude certain things from arbitration or agreed to include certain things from arbitration?
Yes, Your Honor. In 13.16A, which is the first leg of the arbitration provision, it says interpretation or application regarding the terms or provisions of this agreement unless excluded by specific provisions of this agreement. Now, the record, the whole contract isn't in the record, so I don't think Your Honors have that. But there are a handful of things where the parties specifically say this is not subject to arbitration. Performance guidelines isn't one of them. 4.01 isn't one of them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
How do you distinguish the Alcoa case?
The Alcoa case has two important differences. One is the point that I mentioned earlier about bargaining during the term. In the Alcoa case, the matter that was in dispute, that was found not to be arbitrable, had been the subject of negotiations. The union tried, I think that's discussed in the brief, the union tried to get exactly that point, protection exactly on that point, in bargaining, and they failed. The other reason is the Alcoa case says that if a subject is not subject to arbitration and the parties disagree on it, they go back and do a little bargaining, and if they're not able to agree on it then, the union has the right to strike. That's the point Your Honor raised before about the strike. In our case, we don't have the right to strike. Now, here, the company did it during midterm after the negotiated agreement that said had nothing about these new performance guidelines, and we have no right to strike. So those are two big differences with Alcoa. There are also a number of decisions that simply say we decline to follow Alcoa.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
How much time? Mr. Siles, you have 2 minutes, but I'll give you 2 minutes more because we gave your poll. So you have 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a housekeeping point first. There are just cause provisions in the contract. It's sections 13.02 and 13.03. On 4.01, counsel effectively conceded that the union's interpretation would make virtually every dispute between the parties arbitrable. I think the same thing is true if you try to use the back door of the grievance of the discipline provisions to make this dispute arbitrable. Virtually anything that the company sets forth as a policy, you know, use this greeting instead of that greeting and so forth, everything would become arbitrable because if somebody doesn't follow a policy or a direction, it could potentially lead to discipline. Also, on 4.01, I think it's important to note that the union never claimed in its grievance that the company had been disrespectful, never claimed that it acted irresponsibly. Its challenge is to the propriety of these guidelines. That's a substantive challenge, and so 4.01 really has no role to play here. On Alcoa, you can find factual distinctions in every case, but those distinctions have nothing to do with the points that we cited Alcoa for, and I would urge the court, in addition to looking at the precedents from this court that we cited, to pay close attention to the reasoning of Alcoa, which I think is quite persuasive on this question of why the discipline provision shouldn't be used as a catch-all to make everything arbitrable in a contract like this. Finally, we rely entirely on the contract language, but I do want to assure the court that it was reasonable for the parties to agree to limit the universe of arbitrable topics because arbitration is expensive. The parties have to split the costs of it. It's very disruptive, and it's time-consuming. Even without these policy matters being arbitrable, there are hundreds of arbitrations waiting in line between these two parties right now. And if you added every management policy to the arbitration universe, the system would either break down or become prohibitively costly. And I think that helps to explain why the parties agreed to limit the contract.
It's not as disruptive as strikes, though, is it? I mean,
well, there's
give up the strike remedy, you've made things much less disruptive than they might otherwise be, it seems.
Well, there's a no-strike clause. There's no strike issue in this case. But the question is the parties agreed to a particular set of arbitration procedures, and the role of the courts is to enforce the parties' agreement, not to substitute its own views about what might be preferable in terms of union management relations. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.